Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 174th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm FNH. Today we're starting off with the fifth part of the 39 Steps. Next up will be a musical number from 1926, and then onto a bit of modern horror. Let's get started. Chapter 5. The Adventure of the Spectacled Roadman. I sat down on the very crest of the pass and took stock of my position. Behind me was the road climbing through a long cleft in the hills, which was the upper glen of some notable river. In front was a flat space of maybe a mile, all pitted with bog holes and rough with tussocks, and beyond it the road fell steeply down another glen to a plain whose blue dimness melted into the distance. To the left and right were round-shouldered green hills as smooth as pancakes. But to the south, that is, the left hand, there was a glimpse of high, heathery mountains, which I remembered from the map as the big knot of hill which I'd chosen for my sanctuary. I was on the central boss of a huge upland country, and could see everything moving for miles. In the meadows below the road, half a mile back, was a cottage, smoked, but it was the only sign of human life. Otherwise, there was only the calling of the plovers and the tinkling of the little streams. It was now about 7 o'clock, and as I waited, I heard once again that ominous beat in the air, and then I realized that my vantage ground might be, in reality, a trap. There was no cover for a tomtit in the bald green places. I sat quite still and hopeless while the beat grew louder. Then I saw an aeroplane coming up from the east. It was flying high, but as I looked, it dropped several hundred feet and began to circle round the knot of the hill in narrowing circles, just as a hawk wheels before it pounces. Now it was flying very low, and now the observer on board caught sight of me. I could see one of the two occupants examining me through glasses. Suddenly it began to rise in swift whirls, and the next I knew it was speeding eastward again till it became a speck in the blue morning. That made me do some savage thinking. My enemies had located me, and the next thing would be a cordon around me. I didn't know what force they could command, but I was certain it would be sufficient. The aeroplane had seen my bicycle and would conclude that I would try to escape by the road. In that case, there might be a chance on the moors to the right or to the left. I wheeled the machine 100 yards from the highway and plunged it into a moss hole, where it sank amongst the pomweed and water buttercups. Then I climbed to a knoll which gave me a view of the two valleys. Nothing was stirring on the long white ribbon that threaded them. I have said there was not cover in the whole place to hide a rat. As the day advanced, it was flooded with soft, fresh light till it had become a fragrant sunniness in the South African veld. At other times, I would have liked the place, but now it seemed to suffocate me. The free moorlands were prison walls, and the keen hill air was the breath of a dungeon. I tossed a coin, heads right, tails left, and it fell heads, so I turned to the north. In a little, I came to the brow of a ridge which was the containing wall of the pass. I saw the high road for maybe 10 miles, and far down it something was moving, and I took that to be a motor car. Beyond the ridge, I looked on a rolling green moor which fell away into the wooded glens. Now my life on the veld has given me the eyes of a kite, and I can see things for which most men need a telescope. Away down the slope, a couple of miles away, several men were advancing, like a row of beaters at a shoot. I dropped out of sight behind the skyline. That way was shut to me, and I must try the bigger hills to the south beyond the highway. The car I had noticed was getting nearer, but it was still a long way off, with some very steep gradients before it. I ran hard, crouching low except in the hollows, and as I ran, I kept scanning the brow of the hill before me. Was it my imagination? Or did I see figures? One, two, perhaps more, moving in a glen beyond the stream? If you are hemmed in on all sides in a patch of land, there is only one chance of escape. You must stay in the patch and let your enemies search it and not find you. That was good sense. But how on earth was I to escape notice in that tablecloth of a place? I would have buried myself to the neck in mud or lain below water or climbed the tallest tree. But there was not a stick of wood. The bog holes were little puddles. The stream was a slender trickle. There was nothing but short heather and bare hill bent and the white highway. And then, in a tiny bight of road, besides a heap of stones, I found the roadman. He'd just arrived and was wearily flinging down his hammer. He looked at me with a fishy eye and yawned. "Confound the day I ever left the herdin," he said, as if to the world at large. "There I was me in master, and now I'm a slave to the government, tethered to the roadside, with sair in a back, and a back like a suckle." He took up the hammer, struck a stone, dropped the implement with an oath, and put both hands to his ears. "Mercy on me, my head's bustin'," he cried. He was a wild figure, about my own size and much bent, with a week's beard on his chin and a pair of horn-rimmed spectacles. "I canna dent," he cried again. "The surveyor man, just report me. I'm for bed." I asked him what was the trouble, though indeed that was clear enough. "The trouble is, I'm no sober. Last nicht me da a merrin was wedded, and they danced till 4 in the byre. Me and some ither chiddles sat down to the drinking, and here I am. Pity that I ever look it in the wine when it was red." I agreed with him about the bed. "It's easy speaking," he moaned. "But I got a postcard yesterday saying that the new road surveyor would be round the day. He'll come and no find me, or else he'll find me foul. And either way, I'm a dumb man. I'll way back to my bed and say I'm no well, but a tool that'll help me, for there kem my kind o' no willness." Then I had an inspiration. "Does the surveyor know you?" I asked. "No, him. He's just been a week at the job. He rins about in a wee motor car, and would smear the inside out a welk." "Where's your house?" I asked, and was directed by a wavering finger to the cottage by the stream. "Well, back to your bed," I said, "and sleep in peace. I'll take on your job for a bit, and see the surveyor." He stared at me blankly. Then, as the notion dawned on his fuddled brain, his face broke into a vacant, drunkard smile. "You're the Billy," he cried. "It'll be easy enough managed. I finished that bing of stains, so you need a chap only mare this afternoon. Just take the barry and wheel an up metal for yon quarry down the road to make another bing this morn." "My name's Alexander Turnbull, and I've been 7 years at the trade. 20 afore that herding on Leithen Water. My friends came at Ecky, and while Specky, for I wear glasses, being walkie the sit. Just you speak surveyor fair, and call him sir, and he'll be fell pleased. I'll be back. Midday." I borrowed his spectacles and filthy old hat, stripped off coat, waistcoat, and collar, and gave them to him to carry home. Borrowed too the foul stump of a clay pipe as an extra property. He indicated my simple tasks, and without more ado, set off at an amble bedwards. Bed may have been his chief object, but I think there may also have been something left at the foot of a bottle. I prayed that he might be safe under cover before my friends arrived on the scene. Then I set to work to dress for the part. I opened the collar of my shirt, it was a vulgar blue and white check, some such as ploughmen wear, and revealed a neck as brown as any tinker's. I rolled up my sleeves, and there was a forearm which might have been a blacksmith's, sunburnt and rough with old scars. I got my boots and trouser legs all white from the dust on the road, and hitched up my trousers, tying them with a string below the knee. Then I set to work on my face. With a handful of dust, I made a watermark around my neck, the place where Mr. Turnbull's Sunday ablutions might be expected to stop. I rubbed a good deal of dirt also into the sunburn of my cheeks. The roadman's eyes would no doubt be a little inflamed, so I contrived to get some dust in both of mine, and by dint of a vigorous rubbing, produced a bleary effect. The sandwiches Sir Harry had given me had gone off with my coat, but the roadsman's lunch tied up in a red handkerchief was at my disposal. I ate with great relish several of the thick slabs of scone and cheese, and drank a little of the old cold tea. In the handkerchief was also a local paper tied with string and addressed to Mr. Turnbull, obviously meant to solace his midday leisure. I did up the bundle again and put the paper conspicuously beside it. My boots did not satisfy me, but by a dint of kicking amongst the stones I reduced them to granite-like surface which marks a roadsman's footgear. Then I bit and scraped my fingernails till the edges were all cracked and uneven. The men I was matched against would not miss so much of a detail. I broke one of the boot laces and retied it in a clumsy knot, and loosened the other so that my thick grey socks bulged over the uppers. Still, no sign of anything on the road. The motor I had observed half an hour ago must have gone home. My toilet complete, I took up the barrow and began my journeys to and from the quarry, 100 yards off. I remember an old scout in Rhodesia who'd done many queer things in his day, once telling me that the secret of playing a part was to think yourself into it. You could never keep it up, he said, unless you could manage to convince yourself that you were it. So I shut off all other thoughts and switched them on to road mending. I thought of the little white cottage as my home. I recalled the years I had spent herding on Leithen Water. I made my mind dwell lovingly on sleep in a box bed and a bottle of cheap whiskey. Still, nothing appeared on that long white road. Now and then, a sheep wandered off the heather to stare at me. A heron flopped down to a pool in the stream and started to fish, taking no more notice of me than if I'd been a milestone. On I went, trundling my loads of stone with the heavy step of the professional. Soon I grew warm, and the dust on my face changed into solid and abiding grit. I was already counting the hours till the evening should put a limit to Mr. Turnbull's monotonous toil. Suddenly, a crisp voice spoke from the road, and looking up, I saw a little Ford two-seater and a round-faced young man in a bowler hat. "Are you Alexander Turnbull?" he asked. "I am the new country road surveyor. You live at Blackfoot Hope, and have charge of the section from Laidlaw Bides to the Riggs?" "Good. A fair bit of road, Turnbull. Not badly engineered. A little soft about a mile off, and the edges want cleaning. See you look after that. Good morning. You'll know me the next time you see me." Clearly my get-up was good enough for the dreaded surveyor. I went on with my work, and as the morning grew towards noon, I was cheered by a little traffic. A baker's van breasted the hill and sold me a bag of ginger biscuits which I stowed in my trouser pockets against emergencies. Then a herd passed with sheep and disturbed me somewhat by asking loudly, "What had become of old Specky?" "In bed with a colic," I replied, and the herd passed on. Just about midday a big car stole down the hill, glided past and drew up 100 yards beyond. Its three occupants descended, as if to stretch their legs, and sauntered towards me. Two of the men I had seen before from the window of the Galloway Inn, one lean, sharp and dark, the other comfortable and smiling. The third had a look of a countryman, a vet perhaps, or a small farmer. He was dressed in ill-cut knickerbockers, and the eye in his head was as bright and wary as a hen's. "Morning," said the last. "That's a fine easy job of yours." I had not looked up at their approach, and now, when accosted, I slowly and painfully straightened my back, after the manner of the roadman. I spat vigorously after the manner of the low Scot, and regarded them steadily before replying. I confronted three pairs of eyes that missed nothing. "There's worse jobs, and there's better," I said sententiously. "I would rather have yours, sitting a day on your hinderlands and the cushions. It's you and your muckle that causes the wrecks on my roads. If we had the rights, you should be made to mend what you break." The bright-eyed man was looking at the newspaper lying beside Turnbull's bundle. "I see you get your papers in good time," he said. I glanced at it casually. "Aye, good time. Seeing that the paper came out last Saturday, I'm just 6 days late." He picked it up, glanced at the superscription, and laid it down again. One of the others had been looking at my boots, and a word in German called the speaker's attention to them. "You've a fine taste in boots," he said. "These were never made by a country shoemaker." "They were not," I said readily. "They were made in London. I got them frae the gentleman that was here last year for shooting." "What was his name?" And I scratched a forgetful head. Again the sleek one spoke in German. "Let's get on," he said. "This fellow's all right." They asked one last question. "Did you see anyone pass early this morning? He might be on a bicycle, or he might be on foot." I very nearly fell into the trap and told a story of a bicyclist hurrying past in this grey dawn. But I had the sense to see my danger. I pretended to consider very deeply. "I wasn't up very early," I said. "You see, me daughter was married last night, and we keep it up late. I opened the house door about 7. There was nobody on the road then. Since I came up, there's just been the baker, and Ruttle Heard, and besides you gentlemen." One of them gave me a cigar, which I smelt gingerly, and stuck in Turnbull's bundle. They got into their car and were out of sight in 3 minutes. My heart leapt with an enormous relief, but I went on wheeling my stones. It was as well, for 10 minutes later the car returned, one of the occupants waving a hand to me. These gentry left nothing to chance. I finished Turnbull's bread and cheese, and pretty soon I'd finished the stones. The next step was what puzzled me. I could not keep up this road-making business for long. A merciful providence had kept Mr. Turnbull indoors, but if he appeared on the scene there would be trouble. I had a notion that the cordon was still tight round the glen, and that if I walked in any direction I should meet with questioners, but get out I must. No man's nerve could stand more than a day of being spied on. I stayed at my post till about 5 o'clock. By that time I had resolved to go down to Turnbull's cottage at nightfall and take my chance of getting over the hills in the darkness. But suddenly a new car came up the road and slowed down a yard or two from me. A fresh wind had risen, and the occupant wanted to light a cigarette. It was a touring car with the tonneau full of an assortment of baggage. One man sat in it, and by an amazing chance I knew him. His name was Marmaduke Jopley, and he was an offence to creation. He was a sort of blood stockbroker who did his business by toadying eldest sons and rich young peers and foolish old ladies. Marmy was a familiar figure, I understood, at balls and polo weeks and country houses. He was an adroit scandal monger and would crawl a mile on his belly to anything that had a title or a million. I had a business introduction to his firm when I came to London, and he was good enough to ask me to dinner at his club. There he showed me off at great rate, and pattered about his duchesses until the snobbery of the creature turned me sick. I asked a man afterwards why nobody kicked him, and was told that Englishmen reverenced the weaker sex. Anyhow, there he was now, nattily dressed in a fine new car, obviously on his way to visit some of his smart friends. A sudden daftness took me, and in a second I jumped onto the tonneau and had him by the shoulder. "Hello, Jopley," I sang out. "Well met, my lad." He got a horrid fright. His chin dropped as he stared at me. "Who the devil are you?" he gasped. "My name's Hanny," I said, "from Rhodesia, you remember?" "Good God, the murderer," he choked. "Just so, and you'll be a second murder, my dear, if you don't do as I tell you. Give me that coat of yours, that cap too." He did as bid, for he was blind with terror. Over my dirty trousers and vulgar shirt, I put on his smart driving coat, which buttoned high at the top and thereby hid the deficiencies of my collar. I stuck the cap on my head and added his gloves to my get-up. The dusty roadman, in a minute, was transformed into one of the neatest motorists in Scotland. On Mr. Jopley's head, I clapped Turnbull's unspeakable hat and told him to keep it there. Then, with some difficulty, I turned the car. My plan was to go back on the road he had come, for the watchers, having seen it before, would probably let it pass unremarked, and Marmy's figure was in no way like mine. "Now, my child," I said, "sit quite still and be a good boy. I mean you no harm. I'm only borrowing your car for about an hour or two. But if you play me any tricks, and above all, if you open your mouth, as sure as there's a God above me, I'll wring your neck, savvy? I enjoyed that evening's ride. We ran 8 miles down the valley, through a village or two, and I could not help noticing several strange-looking folk lounging by the roadside. These were the watchers, who would have had much to say if I'd come in any other garb or company. As it was, they looked in curiously on. One touched his cap in salute, and I responded graciously. As the dark fell, I turned up a side glen which, as I remember from the map, led into an unfrequented corner of the hills. Soon the villages were left behind, and then the farms, and then even the wayside cottage. Presently, we came to a lonely moor where the night was blackening and the sunset gleam was in the bog pools. Here we stopped, and I obligingly reversed the car and restored Mr. Jopley his belongings. 1,000 thanks, I said. There's more use in you than I thought. Now be off and find the police. As I sat on the hillside watching the tail light dwindle, I reflected on the various kinds of crime I had now sampled. Contrary to general belief, I was not a murderer, but I had become an unholy liar, a shameless impostor, and a highwayman with a marked taste for expensive motor cars. Today's music is by Al Handler's orchestra, with a bouncy track called Mandy. Our main feature today is about 20 minutes long, and it's a self-contained story. That Sick and Rusty Taste by Adam Duncan. It's always night in the garden. A soft blue glow rises from the underwater lights of the swimming pool. The air is warm and motionless, and smells of lilac. A little girl struggles in the midst of the water. Her quiet splashes are the only sound that I can hear. I crouch by the edge of the pool and watch. She grasps, kicks, her head thrown back and her chin slipping under the surface. She's reaching out towards me, peeking out across her cheekbones, coughing and spluttering. No matter how hard she pulls and stomps and claws, she never gets closer. She pleads for my help, begs me with her choking breath. I break down and weep. I can't save her. In the morning, I'm in my bed. I dream of soft white sheets and thick fluffed pillows. I wake in damp linens stained yellow from long summer nights and dark winters of my dreams. Light pours in from above the blind, and I try to hide under the pillow for a few more hours. It's no use. I am awake. The muffled sound of a city winding down seeps through my walls. The 4 o'clock traffic is just getting started. I head to the bathroom and stand in front of the sink. In the mirror, I catch a glimpse of something over my shoulder. I let my eyes focus and notice him standing in my shower. He's a man in his 40s, big build, dressed in a black wetsuit. Fear runs straight down my spine. I've seen this man before, seen him maybe 100 times. But here, in my shower, he makes me shake. I try not to move, try not to look at him, nothing to provoke him. He's completely motionless. He just stands there, breathing heavily, clenching his fists. He smells revolting, like rotten herring and vinegar. Takes everything I have not to gag. I try to pretend that I don't know what he wants, but his eyes tell me everything. Slowly, without looking at him or making a sound, I strip off my clothes and step into the shower. His hot, heavy breath brushes against my back, and I close my eyes tight. He doesn't come any closer, just stands there, watching me, craving me to continue. Without a word, I reach back and pull the curtain. My arm brushes his rubbery suit and I freeze up. Slowly I look back, expecting his anger, but he's already gone. I'm alone again. When the sun begins to set on the city, I feel alive. A fifth of gin helps wash away the pain. The alarm on my phone beeps to let me know I'm late. I throw on my leather jacket and grab a scarf. I'm ready to leave. I take a breath and reach deep under my bed. Takes me some time, not because I don't know where it is, just because I can't bring myself to grab it. When I finally just suck it up and grab it, that familiar panic runs through my fingers. I roll on my back and shove the damn thing into my pocket. Just like always, I start to cough a bit and grab another swig of gin to wash the taste from my mouth. It's a 20-minute cab ride to the house. I called Erkham, but his wife is in her third trimester, and he doesn't think it would be a good time to be around my work. He's right. He sent his cousin instead, a big Ivorian named Gabriel. He's dressed in a missionary blue shirt and hangs a big wooden cross from his rear view. He doesn't talk much, even when I offer in French, and he won't let me drink in the cab. I don't like him. We pull up to the Ehrlich residence at 10:15. When I met Mrs. Ehrlich in the cafe, I guessed she was rich, but I had no idea she was automatic gate rich. I ask Gabriel to come with me. I tell him it's what Erkham always does. He snarls a little and remains seated. "God have mercy on my soul," he says in French, before getting back into the cab. "It's going to be a lonely night." I don't have to knock. A nervous Mrs. Ehrlich meets me at the door and guides me inside. We head through the main hall and into the kitchen. Beyond the kitchen are the glass doors to the garden. She stops at a table and steadies herself. For a moment, I think she's going to collapse, but a misty veil of alcohol and antidepressants somehow holds her together. All she can do is to look down and point to the garden. I walk out, and the night is just as I remember it. There's a cool breeze passing through, and I can smell the soft scent of distant pines. I head down over the stone patio and into the garden proper. The air becomes thicker and warmer, and the scent of pine gives way to the gentle fragrance of lilac. I can hear the soft lapping of the pool water in the filters. The area is completely black. From inside the house, Mrs. Ehrlich turns on the lights, and the pool blinks to life with an eerie blue glow. I take a seat at the edge of the pool and wait. At first, the night is full of life. There are crickets chirping, a wind rustling in the trees, even the distant sound of a fire siren moaning its obscurity. After a while, things die down, and there's only the lapping water, and distant memories of childish laughter. I lie down on my back, empty flask at my side, and try to pick out what stars I can. From the corner of my eye, I catch Mrs. Ehrlich watching me from a second-floor window. They always expect there to be a big show, and there never is. I can't tell if I was lost in thought or starting to dream, but I hear the slight jingle of a dog collar bouncing towards me, and I sit up and watch the darkness. A little orange ball rolls into the light of the pool. A tiny brown curly-haired puppy comes jogging after it. It tries to grip the ball, tail wagging excitedly all the way. From out of the darkness comes the little girl. She's pretty and blonde and dressed in a pink sundress. Her skin is soft white and almost translucent in the shadows. She gleefully pulls the ball from the puppy. It jumps and snaps and runs in little circles. Neither of them pays any attention to me. That's not how it works. The little girl tosses the ball, and it rolls right across the grass, over the stonework, and into the pool. The little dog charges after it and jumps in. When it breaks the surface, it yipes and squeals. The little legs work hard, but it's too young to swim well. The little girl calls out to the dog in a silent voice, but the puppy is facing towards me and away from her. Afraid, the little girl falls forward into the water, reaching out for her beloved pet. It's too deep. She can't swim. Her arms fly wild in desperate efforts to grab the young dog, but each attempt only pushes him away and sends her beneath the surface. I almost can't take it. I want to look away. I can't watch this again. But I can't stop. Can't risk losing this and having to start all over again. The little girl kicks hard, but her body is vertical and she's just barely staying up. The little dog manages to reach the ladder and get some footing on a submerged rung. He turns around and cries in little high-pitched barks. The girl is reaching out towards me and I know she can't see me. She's looking through me towards the house, toward a mother who was drunk then as she is now. Coughing, choking, she's calling out to her parents who have never heard her. Her whole life she's been so afraid and so alone, and this moment is just amplification. I begin to weep, just as before. The puppy paces the rung, testing the water, but it can't bring itself to jump back in. It just stands there, shaking and whimpering, watching the only friend it has ever known start to drown. It's all too much, and I use the sorrow to plunge my hand into my jacket pocket and grab the object. The pain is almost unbearable, but I just keep watching that poor little girl and waiting for the nightmare to end. It doesn't take long for him to come. A dark shadow from the bottom of the pool, the man in the black wetsuit rises from the bottom. Gently, lovingly, he embraces the struggling girl and begins to hold her steady. The girl, her face still barely surfacing from the water, relaxes in his arms. Her eyes never stop looking towards the house, looking for help, crying out in sorrow, but she's calmer now. She feels safe. She turns to look at the man and hugs him gratefully. Slowly the two begin to sink. The man in the black wetsuit carefully cradles her in his arms. She looks peaceful, almost sleep-like as they descend to the bottom. With great care, the man places the girl on the bottom of the pool, and her image dissipates in the flickering shadows. The man begins to rise back to the surface, and I realize that I've not taken a breath. I release the object in my pocket, and my body begins to convulse. Putrid, brackish liquid fills my mouth and nostrils, and I vomit brown, salty water all over my front. I attempt to get up, but another wave hits me and I still can't breathe. Again, my lungs spout the foul and blackened mixture into the pool edge. Finally, I catch some air and pull it, gasping, into my lungs. I fall to my back and look up at the sky. The air is still cool. The only sound is my heavy wheezing. I let my head roll to the side, and I expect to see the empty pool. But the man is still there. He's looking at me. Something's wrong. He should be satisfied, and the spirit of the girl should be at peace. He never sticks around after we've finished. The look in the man's eyes frightens me. He's not vengeful or dominating or even angry. He's afraid. I begin to sit up, startled. "What is it?" I ask him. "What's wrong?" He says nothing, just stares at me. Then, like an invisible truck striking from deep below, the man in the black wetsuit is thrust across the pool. He slams into the side and a dark red cloud begins to form around him. I swivel to one side, trying to get to my feet. His body is dragged around and slammed into the side nearest me. The impact startles me, and I fall to the ground. The man from my shower floats in the middle of the pool, face up, looking at me. His frightened eyes scan the surroundings, but he cannot move. His body sinks beneath the murky crimson surface, and I wait, petrified. From the unsettled waters, a red hand emerges, grasping for help. I take hold and pull, realizing too late that this was not the hand I thought. It wrenches me into the cold, sticky darkness, and I'm enveloped in opaque scarlet billows. I manage to surface and cough for air. A hand grabs me firmly by the ankle and pulls me down. The taste of iron and chlorine fills my nostrils and burns my throat. Closing my eyes tight, I reach for my pocket. But my jacket is twisted, and I can't reach the object. I struggle to find the surface, but I can't even tell which way is up. When I open my eyes, the blood is gone. I'm at the bottom of the pool, facing the underwater light. It's bright and blue, and makes it hard to see anything else. I can't take my eyes off it. The white seems to get brighter, seems to grow. The blue around me is more distant, clearer, and vast. The pool is gone now. The white light is the sun, and it's blinding to look at. I'm on the patio, looking down at the pool. An outdoor table has fallen into the water. Mrs. Ehrlich is there, younger by 10 years, and there's someone else. He's shorter, dressed in work clothes. He looks Latino, a handyman maybe? She's pointing at the table and yelling something. The worker shakes his head. It seems like all I have to do is blink and the scene changes. The workman is in the shallow end of the pool, still in his overalls, and slowly edging his way towards the sunken table in the deep end. When he reaches the middle of the pool, he loses his footing and slides down the incline. His hand slips from the edge and he disappears into the water below. He comes up with a great big flopping arm motion. The water is white and splashing. Mrs. Ehrlich is panicking at the side. She calls out for help, but there's no one around. I blink again, and I am at the pool edge. I can see the pant leg of the worker. It's caught on the table. He struggles hard, but he can't free himself. His arm is so close to the side, but he just can't reach it. Mrs. Ehrlich returns with a long blue pool skimmer. It's twice her height and hard for her to hold. She offers the rounded handle to the drowning worker, but he can't get a grip on it. In frustration, she swings the pole around to offer him the basket. It's too long. She can't control it. It reverberates off the man's temple, and he is suddenly still. Blood begins to waft into the water, and Mrs. Ehrlich drops the pole. I blink, and she's standing on the other side of the pool with a tray full of bottles. I watch as she pours out half a bottle of tequila and a bottle of rum into the pool and throws the empty bottles into the water. She does the same thing with half a dozen beers, wiping down a couple and tossing them into the bushes. Another she drops at the poolside where it smashes into bits. I blink, and I'm standing on the patio again, looking in at the kitchen. She's on the phone, frantic, crying. Behind me, the worker floats in the pool, surrounded by empty bottles, still tethered to the table. I try to sigh, but I realize I can't breathe. I blink, but nothing changes. My eyes are locked on the worker, his blood slowly spreading out into a light pinkish dye. I feel my lungs digging me for air, begging me to breathe. I open my mouth and suck hard at the air. My lungs fill with a painful chlorine taste. My eyes adjust, and I'm at the bottom of the pool. It is night again, and the pool lights are blinding through the clear blue water. My body contorts from the swallow of water. My lungs hack and revolt, but I fight to keep my mouth shut. Can't let myself draw in more. I push off the bottom for the surface, but I feel a tug and realize my pant leg is caught on the filter. I reach down and try to pull it free, but I can't. I fumble with my belt, but I can't release the buckle. I begin to panic. I reach into my pocket. I need his help. Empty. I search around the pool bottom, but I can't find it. My chest burns, and I finally can't hold it. My body quaffs in a mouthful of water and pulls it into my lungs. I begin to shudder uncontrollably. My hands grow tight and begin to clench up. I keep searching for the item, but it's no use. The lights from the pool begin to dim. I've been here before. I close my eyes and try to prepare for the pain, the burning, tearing agony of water flooding my lungs. It's the end. No deals to be made this time. I don't think I heard the splash, or even felt him grab me. But the next time I open my eyes, Gabriel is kneeling above me. He's soaked to the bone and still has the same unimpressed look. I vomit pool water in sickening heaves and pull myself up to my hands and knees. It takes me a minute to remember where I am. Gabriel stands up, grabs me by my shoulder, and pulls me to my feet. "This is a dark place," he tells me. "Not my problem," I reply. We head up to the house. There are only a few lights left on. Mrs. Ehrlich is sitting at the kitchen table with an empty glass. I tell her that Ellie is at peace now. Her daughter just needed someone to see her, to know where she was. The woman begins to cry softly. She asks me if that is all. I look down at the pool. It's still lit with a pale blue glow. The workman stands in the shallow end, his head hanging down motionless in the water. I tell her that I've done all I can, that her daughter is at peace, and I leave. On the cab ride back, Gabriel says nothing to me. I thank him for his help, and he doesn't even look back. He drops me off at my apartment and doesn't wait for me to close the door before pulling away. I spend a moment standing on the sidewalk, looking around. Something catches my eye at the curb. I lean down and take a closer look. It's mine, something I lost, something I had hoped not to see again. It's a little black rubber mouthpiece, the kind that gets used in scuba regulators. My hand trembles as I crouch down and pick it up. That sick, rusty taste comes into my mouth, and I cough up brown phlegm as I shove it in my pocket. I catch him out at the corner of my eye, the man in the black wetsuit. He watches me from the shadows and smiles. Well, that's it for today. Opening music was provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project, and this file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Until next time.
cthulhupodcast.co.uk.